We drove on and in the early afternoon came to our destination. Wrought iron gates and twin classical lodges on a village green. An avenue, more gates, open parkland. A turn in the drive and suddenly a new and secret landscape opened before us. We were at the head of a valley and below us, half a mile distant, grey and gold amid a sea of boscage, shone the dome and columns of an old house. That is the description of Charles Ryder's first sight of Brideshead in Evelyn Waugh's novel Brideshead Revisited.
Thank you, Jeff. Welcome back to the Country House podcast, episode 6, I think. So that's exciting. And we are discussing today the other aspects of the country estate. When you visit one, what might you find there? What is the experience like? And we'll talk about a lot of lesser known, or lesser talked about, rather, aspects. And I wonder if we may even start with the very first thing that you'll see, the first impression of the gate, or the sometimes the gate house, sometimes the gate piers. Well, Connor, why don't you introduce us to that very, very first impression?
Well, as Jeff opened with this romantic approach to an estate, it reminds us that an estate is not planted for utility purposes. These trees are not planted with profitable timber in mind, necessarily. It is an aesthetic decision. And so from the opening at the gatehouse, up the drive to the house, it is an aesthetic consideration as to the placement, the planting, the layout of the estate. And a gate lodge, which for many is the only part of the estate they will see, because the gates are, of course, closed and the house may be some distance from the gate. These gate lodges are found on many roads around the country. They act as a prerequisite to the house themselves. They are an architectural statement. They can be Gothic, classical, festooned with flowers, or a roof of finials in a Gothic tradition. And they often have decorative wrought iron railings flanking either side with a decorative gate. And this not only illustrates the architectural majesty of the estate itself and the architect and the craftsman, but builds anticipation and excitement for what lies beyond. That if this is what the gate lodge looks like, I wonder what the house looks like. And it's in that gate lodge, for security reasons, it makes sense, of course, to have someone at the point of entry into an estate. But historically, this is also the point at which the gatehouse, there's someone to open the gate and close the gate. Of course, today, a lot of gates are electronic or they are left open. And it's passing the gatehouse, gate lodge, and approaching the house along the drive that you'll often find the drive will split between a front drive and maybe deviating off to the right, you'll find a back drive, which leads down to the stables, the outbuildings, and, if you will, the goods delivery, rather than the front of house guest arrival, who would arrive straight to the house. And maybe, Jeff, you might be able to tell us more about what can we find if we continue down that back drive, descending towards the stables and the outbuildings. What
before,
can we expect?
Before we dive into that, could I just interject and point out, I have a question that I think may be interesting about the gate still, which is, when I've visited, and even when I see this all around London as well, where you'll have a lion on the gate pier, or a pineapple. As we know, back then, pineapples were a massive status of wealth and symbol, wealth and status. And I'm wondering how much of that was sort of, you know, when you watch a rugby game and the All Blacks will have a haka to intimidate their opponents, and things of that ilk, when we see these on gate piers, how intentional is that as a sort of status of, look, this is your first idea of what you're about to enter?
I think it's interesting. I think sculptures, full stop, often told stories on an estate. So yes, you're right. Lions, they might imply a royal lineage or something like that. You might have a rampant lion or a griffin that features on the coat of arms of the family. You might have stags on gate piers. Sometimes it spoke a story about told a story about the family who lived in the house. Sometimes it was simply a symbol of grandeur. Like you said, you know, a pineapple on a gate pier might simply imply wealth. There's a great house down in Devon that's now the house is now demolished. It belonged to the Baring family of Baring's Bank, Lord Ashburton's family, and can't remember the name of the house, but the gate lodge and gate piers still stand. And on either of the on the gate piers, there is a bull and a bear, which was a reference to the fact that the Baring family made their money in banking through carefully investing in bull and bear markets. So the bull and the bear referred to the bull and bear markets that we talk about in economics. And that is the means through which the Barings made their wealth. So that was a really quite a cool story. And, you know, it's very near where my parents live in South Devon, this gate lodge. And I drive past it often. And sadly now the gates are closed and there's cars parked in front of it because the gate lodge is now an independent house. There's no drive. There's no main house at the end of the drive, which tells a story in itself. But the fact that the bull and the bear are still there is a lovely reference to how the Barings made their wealth. So they often can tell stories. And also the gate lodges, as Connor implied earlier in his introduction, is, you know, the gate lodges tell the story of the architect, often tell the story of the architectural development of the house. So you might, for example, have a classical gate lodge, you know, a pediment and pillars, you know, a stately home in miniature, so to speak. That was in turn referring to the main house, but the main house might subsequently have been Gothicized in the Victorian era or knocked down and replaced with an arts and crafts house. But often they didn't replace the gate lodges at the same time. So sometimes, you know, I'll give an example is Eaton Hall, which is the Duke of Westminster's house. The gates and the gate piers and the gate lodges all stem from the time when there was a beautiful Georgian country house at Eaton Hall in Cheshire. Now there's a modernist 1950s house there. I mean, it still has extraordinary parterres and Victorian gardens because Eaton Hall has had an extraordinary history. I mean, it's a testament to the Dukes of Westminster's wealth that they continually each generation knocked down the house and built something bigger or different. So, you know, there was an amazing, beautiful Queen Anne house, not dissimilar to sort of Buckingham Palace. But more Queen Anne in style. That was replaced with a Victorian house, was replaced with a Palladian house, which was in turn replaced with a big Victorian castle, you know, almost looked like Hogwarts. And then that in turn was knocked down and replaced with a modernist 1950s house. So again, the gate lodges and the gate piers tell stories of the previous houses that stood on the site of this now modernist 1950s block. Is that fair to say, Connor?
Yes, that does often happen. Another additional, in addition to what you're mentioning with the sculptures, that you'll often find that there's pine cones on the pillars, if it's gate piers, and that in the classical world is the meaning of a warm welcome to guests. So to have them on the gate piers is in the tradition of welcoming guests into the house.
My favorite things I've learned from you so far, Connor, that I never took into consideration beforehand when I was visiting these estates is what the story is as you're driving through the gates and up the drive. I had never paid attention. I just looked and be like, oh, isn't it gorgeous, as we drive up to the real thing to see, which was the house. But actually, as we'll discuss now, that whole story, we should pay more attention to that. But you asked Jeff something before I interrupted about the back drives, was it?
Oh no, I think let's continue with what you were saying with the front. Yeah, I was mentioning the back drive to Jeff about descending down into the outbuildings, the stables. But just continuing from what you're saying about the front drive, what our listeners must appreciate when they enter an estate, that the pathway, the route, is designed just as much as the landscape and the house, and it's purposeful. The placement of a turn and a bridge within that route is part of building your anticipation of what lies at the end, but also adding drama and theatre to that journey from the gate to the house. And an example of this would be, which this is an example you could apply to many estates, where you see the house in the distance, you cross almost like a lawn, just the house is in the distance, you descend into a wooded area, it's concealed, and then perhaps it bends around, and all of a sudden you see the house a little bit closer, but you're back in trees again, and this time maybe you get glimpses of it through the trunks of the trees, intermittent glimpses, and then once again it's hidden from view, until all of a sudden the drive arrives at the front of the house, and imagine a classical piece of music. This is the crescendo roar of what you have just witnessed, the long procession, and now you're seeing it in its full glory. And that approach, which is typical of a Georgian, a Capability Brown landscape, for example, this approach builds drama, theatre to an estate in a way that a drive approaching, like Cliveden, for example, it can be impressive, but doesn't have the same effect as just driving straight to the house and your view does not change from start to end. So there's many ways in which the landscape gardener laid out these tracks. And to this day, on new estates or perhaps an old estate, is changing the route to the house. And all these views and moments are taken into consideration. There's a term we use, which is the existing view and the emerging view. So if you're traveling at a slower pace in the car, that there is a view that you're witnessing at that time, but as you approach the house closer, there's always something emerging and something else disappearing.
I think that's really helpful, Connor. And again, you mentioned that it's common in Capability Brown Parklands or Humphrey Repton Parklands to have that emerging view and that the tastes and the glimpses of the house before you get the final view. And again, you look at the country house history, as we did in our early episodes, looking at the development of the country house architecturally, the parkland obviously changed with it, or the gardens changed with it. And so, for example, some of the early restoration houses like Belton House, which we talked about, which is one of the inspirations for our logo, being a 17th century house, although it was a pioneering in terms of its architectural style with its big Georgian sashes and classical features, when Belton was built, it didn't, it was pre-Capability Brown and Repton. So they've got a straight drive that runs straight up from the gates to the house. Whereas the slightly later houses, the English Baroque, the Castle Howards and Blenheims and later Georgian country houses, the idea of parkland had developed more. So rather than formal gardens like you had at Belton, you had the parklands. And although the parklands were often added on to houses like Belton at a later time, sometimes they kept the drive. So that's where Belton's an interesting example of an early classical house that has a straight drive, whereas we tend to associate classical Tudor houses with straight drives or Elizabethan houses with straight drives and the classical houses with more winding, sort of tantalizing glimpses in their approaches. And then we came back to, like I said, with Eaton Hall, for example, the Victorian era was a reversion to sort of pre-Georgian formality. So often you saw the introduction in the Victorian era of, again, parterres in the gardens, less parkland, more formal gardens, and again, straight approaches. Hence, for example, Eaton Hall having a straight approach from its main entrance. So it's interesting. You can... the parkland adapted with the houses, and I think Connor also and Ben, we talk about the glimpses that obviously there are glimpses of the house, but there are also glimpses of other buildings in the parkland. As you meander through the park, you might not see the house first, but you might see, like you said earlier, Connor, a bridge. You might cross a bridge, a beautiful classical bridge, or if you think of the likes of Stourhead or Stowe or I'm thinking Prior Park or Wilton in Wiltshire, the Earls of Pembroke's house, you've got these Palladian bridges, which again gave a taster of the architecture to come in the house. Can you talk, Connor, a little bit more about some of the other buildings you might see in the park on the approach before you see the main house?
Yes, follies and bridges. So a folly, of course, means building without purpose, but many times a folly in itself as a beautiful aesthetic piece in the landscape, its purpose is being a beautiful object. It is something, an eye catcher, not only catching your attention as you meander through the landscape, through the parkland to the house, but in the house, it may align with the entrance door or with an important room, and creates interest on the landscape, but also a reason to walk out to it with a friend, provide shelter during rainfall, terminate a view. There might be an avenue of trees, and there's a folly, such as a circular temple, or it may be a proper room, as we see in, say, Castle Howard, where they have a temple with that is a Baroque room in itself with doors and windows. So in a way, it's like a summer house, or it might be an obelisk. And these are anchor points in the landscape and bring the architecture outside beyond the scope of just the country house itself. Are there any follies in particular, Jeff, that you're particularly fond of?
Well, you mentioned the Temple of the Four Winds at Castle Howard, which is iconic because, again, reverting back to my introduction and that quote from Brideshead Revisited, you know, in Brideshead, especially in the 1980s adaptation of Brideshead Revisited with Anthony Andrews and Jeremy Irons, there's that wonderful scene of Sebastian Flight and Charles Ryder and Julia Flight having their decadent sort of dinners and parties in the Temple of the Four Winds at Castle Howard, where Brideshead was filmed, and which has become sort of synonymous with that house. So yeah, that's, I think, Temple of the Four Winds, and it's interesting because, I mean, what I love about follies is you can have such different, you know, I think Stowe is probably the most famous landscape in England for its follies, and a number of them are now holiday cottages because they're quite substantial buildings, you know. You can rent them out through the Landmark Trust or through the National Trust. These amazing Gothic, Georgian, Baroque, Palladian follies scattered around the landscape. Stourhead similarly has a wonderful selection of follies, and they do act as eye catchers. But now they're much more utilitarian, and they've been converted some of these into two 3-bedroom cottages.
Or you take Andrew Lloyd Webber's, for example, who uses his folly. That, in fact, that's where Phantom of the Opera was first ever played, was in his folly, where he often tests his musicals.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, and there are also, you know, that's the thing, is actually some follies, I think, they're, you know, are almost classical theatres, you know, sometimes, or you know, I think of some country houses that have been restored recently, for example, Heveningham Hall, I think it is in Suffolk, which is the Hunt family's home, the chap who founded Foxton's, and he's built a sort of auditorium, which is not quite a folly because it's landscaped into the lawns, but it's he's created an outdoor theatre. So there are practical purposes for these garden features that are used, and of course you could talk about today. You could talk about country house operas. So, you know, the likes of Garsington, Grange Park, Glyndebourne, and Neville Holt, where they've built opera houses in the grounds. You know, in a way, an opera house is a folly, but it's a practical folly. It's, you know, not always beautiful. I think the opera house at Glyndebourne isn't particularly aesthetically appealing, but for example, the one at Grange Park is a really charming red brick auditorium hidden in the woods. It's known as the Theatre in the Woods, tucked away behind West Horsley Place. You can't see it from the house. It doesn't spoil the landscape, but you go through the walled garden through a door, and there's this beautiful, exquisite sort of red brick auditorium that is the opera house. And it sort of is a folly in some ways, but it's got a practical purpose. It hosts country house operas in the summer. And so, you know, we've adapted these follies and adapted these buildings over the years to suit our modern needs.
Considering an eye catcher in the landscape, last week's episode with the Duchess of Rutland, she of course created a new eyecatcher in the landscape with her expansion of the parkland following the designs of Kate Bilty Brown. And this was a timber obelisk with a peacock and its plume, which is the symbol of the Manners family, I believe. And this stands now in the landscape. It's, of course, it won't last as long as something of stone, but it shows that the tradition of sculpture, craftsmanship, architecture extending from the house into the landscape still continues. And looking at it from the perspective of a house, that these anchors, these sentinels in the landscape, do in a way depend on the house. They are isolated without the existence of the country house. And an example of this would be Beelan House in the middle of Ireland. Beelan House was a grand country house of a very large scale, but it fell into disrepair at the end of the 19th century, I believe. But the thing is, it was demolished in the 20th century. It was a ruin for many years. And the Follies still exist within the estate. But of course, the estate is long gone. There's nothing to show that the house was ever standing here. There's some partial ruins of a stables. But amongst the surrounding farmland, you will find a granite obelisk or a circular temple with a domed roof, and the robustness of the construction means that they have stood the test of time. These are stone monoliths, and they stand in isolation. What they belonged to no longer exists, and it's without the existence of the house and their place in the landscape in relation to that that they seem lost and truly folly without purpose. But nonetheless beautiful, they stand there in farmland.
That's really helpful, Connor. And you mentioned the Duchess of Rutland's new folly, the obelisk or the column with the topped with a peacock that she did in the last decade. Perhaps the most famous new folly that's been built in recent years is a folly designed by Quinlan Terry, the famous classical architect for Sir Nicholas Coleridge, the former chair of the V&A. You can read about it in magazines like Country Life. He built an extraordinary folly in red brick to match his house, Wolverton Hall, but with beautiful OG windows topped with a cupola. So a sort of slightly flamboyant and extravagant folly, which fits perfectly within the landscape and is actually by the swimming pool. And it's got a double usage as his study and as a pool house. So it's very practical, but very beautiful. And, you know, rather than just building a low level single story pool house or an outdoor study, he decided to combine the two into a beautiful folly. And it's well worth looking up the Wolverton Folly on the internet, because it's a really a beautiful award winning architectural piece of design that shows that follies aren't obsolete in today's society. We can create beautiful, practical, small buildings on estates.
I've seen that. It's beautiful. Yeah. You segued nicely into another thing that I wanted to learn about, Jeff, if you don't mind, which is you mentioned the swimming pool. And I don't know if you're referring to a more modern swimming pool at that place, but another sort of anchor in the landscape or something totally noticeable when you're walking around the parkland are these pools, serpentine lakes that you see often, massive bodies of water like at Chatsworth in Derbyshire. But I was wondering why they're there, if they are purely aesthetic or if there are any links to that movement of medicinal properties of sea bathing and fresh water swimming and things like that, if either of you know.
Well, the thing about the Serpentine Lake or the planting of oak trees spread amongst the parkland is about creating the Arcadian landscape, this romantic setting in which the house sits. And the Serpentine Lake, which of course Kate Bilty Brown is famous for and was also used by Humphrey Repton and many disciples since, is by its shape, you cannot tell really where it starts and ends. So it seems more natural as opposed to a pond, which has defined boundaries, all of which can be seen from the shore. With a serpentine lake, it may bend around a corner, and around the corner it comes to an end, but you don't see that end, suggesting that perhaps it flows into a river.
You talk, Connor, about the Serpentine Lakes being created to you know, give a sense of no beginning and no end. They're often formed by damming streams or rivers. And then you would often find at the end of the lake there would be a weir or something, or a waterfall where the water would flow down and then revert back into a river. Obviously, there were practical things as well. You know, the fact is these lakes acted as great reservoirs to irrigate the land, to irrigate the estate, and to provide water for the house. So even when the streams were running low, or running dry, I should say, the lakes would have had a capacity to ensure that even in the driest summers there was plenty of water to irrigate the estate and to supply the house. And likewise with these lakes you talked about, you know, obviously there's the aesthetic, there's the fun, the aspect of being able to boat on the lake or swim in it or so forth. But also we've got to think about the long-term repercussions of actually creating these lakes and sometimes damming rivers meant for several years until the lake had, or at least for several months until the lake had filled up. There would be no water running downstream. And there's a great story of Milton Abbey, that extraordinary setting down in Dorset, which was built by the Dawson Damer family, which is now possibly, after Stowe, the most beautiful school in England. When Milton Abbey was built, they had to relocate at least one, possibly two villages to create the parkland setting and the lake. So I think it was certainly one village. They had to rebuild an entire village off the estate. And there's a great story of when Milton Abbey was created, when the lake was dammed, the squire who lived in the neighboring estate actually had to move because his estate no longer had a water supply. So when the Damers built Milton Abbey and dammed the river to create their enormous lake, the Chichesters who lived further downstream had to relocate to their hunting lodge, which became their principal home, because their main house no longer had a water supply. So, you know, the links in with the rivalries between these families and the decadence in some ways of the, you know, the fact that the Damers could turf out that, you know, a reference back to the feudal system, the fact that these landowners could simply relocate the entire village, you know, submerge the church underwater and create a whole new, and a whole new village off-site. And there are stories of country houses where, you know, legend has it, when the lake is very low, the steeple of the church can be seen poking up above the waterline. Realistically, that's probably not entirely true, because the steeple would have rotted away and collapsed under the water. But it's a lovely idea that, you know, you can see a village through the water.
Jeff, am I right in saying that in order to fill the ice house and provide ice through the summer months, or at least in the spring, that it's when the water is shallow in the lakes that, because of course in many of them being dammed, they can regulate the height of the water, that the ice is taken from there to the ice house?
Yeah, the ice in the ice house often came from the lake in the winter months and then was kept stored deep underground in the ice house and remained frozen throughout the summer months. Yes, that's absolutely true. I'm just trying to think, you know, I know our listeners like stories of people. You know, there are some great stories of families. It's a slight tangent, but I don't know if either of you have seen To the Manor Born, that wonderful 1980s drama with Penelope Keith, where she sold her ancestral home, but in doing so bought the gate lodge and lived at the end of the drive. And it's a slight reversion back to our original discussion on gate lodges, but it's quite a fun drama about, you know, the relationship between the new owner of the house and the original owner. Her living in the gate lodge and him driving past every day, and the story of their relationship. But you do find with estates often, you know, as houses are sold off, that the family maintain the land, or at least, or and often own the villages still. So there's this relationship you find sometimes in modern country houses today, where perhaps a family has recently bought a country house or has bought it in the last sort of couple of decades, but the original family who lived in that home as their ancestral home might still own the surrounding estate, or the villages and so forth. You know, the village near where I grew up in Surrey, Shere, which is famous for the setting for The Holiday and Bridget Jones. It's a very pretty village in the Surrey Hills. The Bray family own the village and the surrounding estate, but the main house is now split up into apartments, and they live in the home farm. So again, there's an element of sort of new meets old, and again, you know, and now they're renting out their follies to, or they might be renting out their follies to holiday, or as holiday lets or whatever. You see the adaption of the country house and its estate, which is quite an interesting, you know, development in the last few decades.
As sort of an appendage to that, Jeff, when we are looking, we heard near the end of our interview with the Duchess of Rutland about the sort of homogenization of conglomerate owned country houses versus the real soul and heart of the privately owned ones. And is that the storytelling that we're talking about in the choices in the parkland and the drive up and these, the parterres and things like this? What differences might we expect in what we can expect in a country estate from one that is privately owned versus a conglomerate owned one? I know this might be a topic for a complete other episode, but you know, we're talking about what to expect there. And I feel like when I visit conglomerate owned country houses, there is that sort of homogeny going on. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think, you know, it depends honestly on how desperately an estate needs to commercialize their assets, because, you know, the privilege of country house owners who still own their houses and estates is they can choose what to sort of commercialize and what not to. Whereas if it's owned by the National Trust or English Heritage or owned by a hotel chain, then everything is about profit. So they'll want to utilize, you know, they might turn the stables into lots of holiday cottages, and they might turn all the follies into holiday cottages. And, you know, the village, you know, I think about National Trust owned villages like down at Kingston Lacey. Most of those houses are now holiday cottages rather than houses for tenant farmers and tenants, because they make more money from holiday lets than they do from tenant farmers and historical tenants. So whereas I think going back to some of the stuff we talked about in past episodes about stewardship, you know, the beauty of owning an estate, if you're fortunate enough to own one, is you can also, it's that sense of noblesse oblige, and actually, you know, you can rent your cottages at a more reasonable rate to people who have rented it for years and years and years and years, and you're not just looking at the bottom line. Whereas I think you'll find big commercial organizations that own country houses, they just want a quick profit. So I think that's the main difference, really, between houses that are still privately owned and houses that are owned by big corporations.
Well, if I may just add to what Jeff said by the short paragraph that we had mentioned just before we started, in relation to the ownership and what effect this has on the locality and the surrounding countryside, that land will always be owned. It's going to be owned by someone. And in this book, it talks about he is imagining the abolition of primogeniture, which is where the eldest son inherits. And of course, we've seen on the continent that where this is abolished, an estate becomes inviolable in the future because it is essentially broken up amongst siblings as time goes on. But he talks here about land will always be bought and held in great quantities, but it will be held by men of business and no longer able to look forward to the permanence of occupancy and having no motive for securing the goodwill of the people around them. We will regard their possession from a money point of view and will aim at attaining the largest possible amount of profit and pleasure for themselves. So this continues to what Jeff was saying. But in contrast to that, as we heard from Emma in the episode last week, the Duchess of Rutland, the traditional landowner, by contrast, was not interested in business or profit, but shouldered his many responsibilities, protected the poor, supported local charities, built hospitals, churches, and schools, and produced feast and merrymaking for the populace on great occasions.
And we haven't even got onto the house yet. You know, we've talked about follies, we've talked about bridges, we've talked about, we haven't even talked about family mausoleums and their architectural role on the landscape. But there's lots more to talk about. And obviously we need to talk about the house too. So maybe that's for our next episode, is talking about, as we've gone up the drive, seen glimpses of the house, seen the follies, seen the landscape, and then we draw up in front of the house and you know, the footman might be lining the steps and the butler might come down to greet you at the front door, and then you go into the house, and we'll have to follow on with that in our next episode, talking about what we find inside.
Absolutely, Jeff. And we haven't even finished the outside, you know, dovecotes, kennels, there's so much. I mean, that's why we do the podcast, right? Because, you know, in 2 years' time, we can do an episode of, you know, the elegance of ornate chamber pots or something, you know, that's the beauty of it. But
I was going to just add to that, Ben, that of course, in discussing the why behind the what, whether it be the folly, the bridge, the approach to the house, it will hopefully, with our listeners understanding these different elements, it will enrich their experience on a country estate.
Yeah, it certainly will for me. It certainly will for me. And I'm sure for many others listening too, that when they are driving through up to the house, that experience will be changed and enhanced now. So thank you for that. And thank you all for joining us. I hope you have had a very Merry Christmas, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.